Earl, what's the name of this team?
The Nashville Skyline Rag.
It's time for the Sappycast, and I'm your host, Scott C. Hey, happy early holiday weekend to you from the Sappycast. Hope you got some plans coming up for one of the highlights of the summer months. Traditionally, one of the highlights. Maybe you're going to see a baseball game of some type. Maybe just blow some stuff up with fireworks. Or maybe just, if you're going to be like me, sit down and marathon all the Star Wars movies. Except for episode one, for obvious reasons. It still hurts. Anyway, one thing you might consider doing if you're a writer is take some time to write or revise a manuscript that weekend. Why? Because Sundress Publications has an open call for manuscripts. In July, they are looking for full-length poetry manuscripts. First time ever that Sundress has been doing this. And the deadline, though, is July 19th, so you can use maybe this holiday weekend to catch up on some writing, finishing it off, maybe revising it, prepping it, and sending out for submission. The deadline is July 19th, as I said, for full details. You can look at sundresspublications.com and get all the details on that. Also, visit our web store there at sundresspublications.com and click on store, and you can visit and see all the details there under Submit a Manuscript. Now, maybe poetry isn't your thing. Maybe you're more of a storyteller, more of a fiction prose storyteller, but you also really dig the steampunk genre. Well, it just so happens that Sundress is also looking for works about steampunk for an anthology and performance that is going to happen, but the deadline on that is August 1st. For information about that one as well, all the details. There's so much here to list, and if I want to get to the episode today, I gotta make this brief and just tell you, go to sundresspublications.com. All of the details for both of these calls for submissions are there for both the poetry manuscript and the steampunk anthology. But again, those due dates are coming up on you really quickly. July 19th for poetry, August 1st for the one and the only steampunk anthology. Now, today's show is a wonder. It is a treat. It is a great time that we have with the one and the only Julie Brooks Barber is on the program. We have wanted her on this program for a while, and we have her at last. Haha, it's like Pokemon. You got to catch all the poets. You know, it's like Poetmon? I don't know. Trying to be clever, but how's that working out for me? Being clever, I mean. You know. Anyway, today's program is a great one. Julie is an awesome person, and I know you'll soon see that and everything. Now, one programming note about today's episode. If you've never been to Florida during the summer months, then you don't know about this, but there's what I call the 3 o'clock special. It's usually a big, massive thunderstorm, comes around 3 p.m. almost every summer day, and sometimes it's powerful enough to kind of cause a power surge in the places where people live. And sometimes power gets knocked out, and it just so happened that midway through our talk here, the power blew on this. Now, luckily, we were able to save the episode, but I just thought I'd give you a warning. Don't worry, you'll know when it's coming, because, well, listen for the signal. Anyway, but that's later on. Before that, there's a lot of awesome stuff, but before you get to enjoying it, here's the theme song. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am waiting for my husband to bring me a glass of water.
Ah, gotcha. Well, it is a pleasure to have you on the program. It feels like I just talked to you like yesterday.
I know.
As we, for those who don't know, we spent a little time at Firefly this summer, enjoying our summer break. Yeah, but we wanted you on the program well before that, though.
Oh, that's nice of you. Thank you.
Yeah, and we're glad to finally have you here. So, let's get down to business here, as I always start off every interview with the burning question that is on everyone's mind. You ready?
Yeah.
Denim pants plus a denim shirt or denim jacket. Fashion faux pas or wave of the future?
Lord, don't wear that.
Why not?
Oh, I just can't stand all that denim. That's too much. It's a faux pas to me.
Well, you're in North Michigan. I mean, surely you see it around, I'm guessing, there.
Yeah, I've seen people do it, but I don't think I could make myself do it. My daughter could do it. She can pull it off. And I've seen other people pull it off, but I just can't.
Why is that, do you think?
I just don't like it. I don't like all that denim. It doesn't feel right to me. So, I don't know if it's from heritage or what. Like, I don't really... Do I see Southerners doing that? I don't know.
It has the derisive name, the Canadian tuxedo.
Now, I did see a woman when I was in Texas, when I was pregnant with my daughter. And this was in Houston, Texas. And she was pregnant, and she had on, like, a denim, like, jumpsuit. And she looked awesome. And I was like, man, I could never pull that off. It's like you have to do it just right, or you make the risk of just looking, like, mismatched and crazy. Maybe if it were the same color. You can't do different colors of denim. That looks crazy.
Can't have black denim pants.
No, and you can't do the light denim with the dark denim. It just looks weird.
You look like a patchwork quilt.
Exactly.
Some people can rock denim, some can't. You know.
Denim with cowboy boots looks really awesome. That's what I like.
That might be the southerner in you saying that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks good. I mean, you have the right boots, and you have just the right jeans. It looks really, really good together. Yeah, that's probably the southern in me. I've seen women do that and look so, so good. So
I have as well. So you're up in northern Michigan, but it's quickly established, I think, talking to you, that is not your home country.
No, I'm actually from Shelby, North Carolina, which is in the western part of the state.
Is that where Andy Griffith is from?
Andy Griffith is from Mount Pilot, which is above Greensboro. That's more the Piedmont area.
How far away is that from Shelby?
About 2.5 hours. Because I went to school, I went to college in the Piedmont, in that area.
So you were born in Shelby then?
No, I was actually born in outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And then when I was about a year old, my parents moved to the Shelby area, because that's where my dad's from.
And you spent your childhood in Shelby, then?
Oh, yeah, I grew up there. So from, like, one on, yeah. But my mom is actually originally from Georgia, so she and my dad met there, and then I was born in Atlanta, out outside of Atlanta, and then they moved up.
Was your dad from North Carolina?
He was. We moved back to the area he grew up in.
Just job opportunity came up and decided to move the family?
He went to school. He got his master's in science education at UVA and then taught in the mountains for a while and then moved to Georgia, met my mom. And then I guess he always wanted to raise his kids in North Carolina. And my grandfather was a farmer, so I think he wanted us to be around that area and he wanted to be around his parents. So it was really cool to grow up around my family, at least one side.
Did you get the chance to go back to see the other side in Georgia often?
Not very, because they all moved away. My aunt was the only one who stayed in Georgia, and my grandmother lived there till I was about 15. Then she moved to Virginia. But one of my uncles settled outside of Hampton, Virginia, and the other uncle lives in Lancaster, South Carolina, like around the Lancaster area in South Carolina. So they all kind of spread out. So we would see them, like sometimes we saw the uncle in South Carolina more often because we would be able to drive there a little bit faster because Hampton was a ways away, you know. But yeah, it just depended on who was able to travel when and when we were able to get there. So no, I really wish I would have been able to go to Georgia more often, but I didn't.
When did you leave the South and why?
Well, mostly because of my husband's work. I graduated from UNC Greensboro with an MFA, 99 is when we left. And we left for my husband to get his PhD in English at University of Kentucky. So that's why we left.
Is he also a native Southerner?
He is. He's actually from Eastern North Carolina. So we're both from the Carolinas.
And so he winds up in Michigan, or did you wind up in Michigan first?
We both wind up in Michigan. So we never lived apart. So when one of us left, both of us leave. So he got a job up in at Lake Superior State University, and so we all left and came up here.
So you've traveled around a bit then?
I guess you could say that. I've lived in some pretty cool places.
What do you miss most about the South?
Food first, because I think you know I love cheer wine.
Indeed.
And I miss food. I miss the landscape a lot. I love the mountains a lot. I miss the fauna and the flora. I really miss the plants really bad. I have a cardinal dogwood in my front yard because I love dogwood so much. If I could grow a magnolia tree up here, I would do it in a second, but the climate is just not right for that kind of tree. I miss the people. I miss the accent a whole heck of a lot. When I was at SAFTA, there was this woman who lived down the street. She brought some new ducks to SAFTA, so, or the Firefly Farms, and she had this great mountain accent. I was like, man, I miss the South so bad, because I could sit and listen to people talk all day. And that's Tennessee, so I actually got more of an ear for dialects when I moved away. But yeah, I miss the accent really bad. If you take me to the South anywhere, I would just pretty much bathe in accents all day. I could just sit and listen to people talk. Those are the major things that I miss. And I miss I miss people, too. I do.
Certain friends and family, yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of my a lot of people move away. A lot of my friends who, you know, lived in North Carolina for a long time moved away. But I'm still meeting people who are actually in the area now who've moved there from other states. Like at AWP, I met a couple people from North Carolina who hadn't lived there their whole lives, but lived there long enough for it to be home. So I keep meeting people from there. It never stops.
When you go back down south, do you find your accent changes? Does it become more pronounced? Do you go back in a way, revert to your accent of childhood?
Oh yeah, automatically. When I come back home, usually we stay for about 2 weeks because we have a lot of family to see when we go visit. And then when I come back, I can hear the Upper accent's really, really strong to me. The UP accent, it's really, really strong to me because I've been around my family for so long. But yeah, I pick it right back up. No problem. Yeah.
Immediately just comes right back in.
Oh, yeah, automatically. I can tell it's stronger when I haven't been at work for a while. If I've just been at home with you know, my husband and my daughter, and I haven't been going out much, maybe I've been reading and writing a lot, I can tell that the accent gets thicker, you know, if I'm not around people a whole lot.
Now, your daughter was not born and raised in the South, but does she have a bit of the Southern accent to her?
She actually does. There's certain words that she tells me that her friends say that she says with a little bit of a drawl. They don't know how to describe it that way, but there's certain words that she'll say where she'll elongate the vowels just from being around us. So she doesn't necessarily have a Upper, which is what we call the accent up here in the people. She doesn't have that Upper accent, but she has, she has a twang of it, but it's kind of a mixed accent for her.
Just a little touch of it in there.
Just a bit, yeah.
I'm fascinated by linguist and dialect. I'm from upstate New York, and it's very difficult for me to read the word prescription and say it prescription. I always keep reverting to prescription.
Or I'll say prescription.
I want to think it's an upstate New York thing with me. It's a verbal tic. I know the word is prescription.
Well, so how would a New Yorker say it?
Oh, I'm going down to the store to get my prescription.
Oh, yeah, I would never say it that way. You were born to be a Southerner. That's the thing.
I've wondered that, honestly. When I was 11 years old, I started thinking I had this gut feeling that I needed to be in the South for some reason. And I finally got the chance to move away, and I chose to go to Mississippi, and sure enough, that's where I get my PhD. I meet my future wife, and
right.
Meet a whole, you know, friends who are now my friends for 10 years later.
That's kind of how it happens. I mean, you go to a place and you kind of put down roots and everything starts coming together. It's weird that way. No matter where you move, it seems to happen that way.
Is that what happened when you moved to Upper Michigan?
And Kentucky. It's just really strange. I mean, I think that if you really want something somewhere and you want to be part of a community, you start to seek out people who are part of that community and just get to know them and get to know what they do. And that happened in Kentucky for me, and it happened in Michigan for me. So I think it's just part of what we do. I think it's part of what anyone does. If you're really interested in something or you want to make something your life, you kind of follow it and find people who are already interested in that and find out how to make connections. It's kind of slow, but it happens. I mean, it takes me about 2 or 3 years in a place to really start figuring out who's who. And if I want to try something out or try something new, who would I go to make that happen?
How do you do that in a new city?
Well, for me, you just have to start asking questions. Who knows what? Who does this in town? Just start talking to people and get to know people, because usually someone will know someone else who knows someone else. You know, usually in a community kind of like Lexington, Kentucky, or even Sault Ste. Marie, people know people. And I think most cities would probably have some kind of small town feel to them anyway. So you kind of make sure you plant your feet in the right places. And like I like libraries, and usually the people in libraries for a writer, they know who's doing what. They usually know who's doing what in the community, and you can usually start making things, if you're a writer, you can usually start making things happen at libraries or literacy centers or something like that, just by making yourself available to the community. But people don't really have to know that you're published, they just need to know that you're interested. That's all they need to know. So I think just showing an interest is really the main thing. Because if you can show the passion, people are going to say, oh, well, I want to help this person out, or I know people who might, this person might want to talk to. Have you talked to this person? Have you talked to this person? That's kind of what, I mean, that's what people do. They want to, if they know you really love something, they're going to make sure you know the right people. That's kind of human nature, I think, to do that. People are mostly nice for the most part. I mean, despite what we see all in the news, people are pretty good for the most part and are willing to help. I'm probably naive, but that's how I think.
There's a song lyric from Rush that I think of. You know, folks are basically decent. We just read about the very rare ones in the paper every day.
And I think that when we do that, as I kind of noticed, you know, over the past couple of weeks, that people have a lot of love for other people in their hearts, and they want to see good things happen. And so you can kind of, at the same time that you feel all of the sadness, you also feel at the same time all of this love that people have for each other. And it's heartbreaking to me that, you know, that we have to go through the sadness to kind of figure out how much we love each other, you know? So I've been thinking about that a lot over the past couple of weeks.
You know, national focus right now is on the Carolinas, both north mm-hmm. and south.
Right.
And not necessarily where you're from, though, if memory serves me right, Ruff was found near Shelby.
He was found in Shelby, not far from where I grew up. So hearing your hometown in the news after a shooting really makes your stomach plummet. What is he doing there? Thank God they caught him in Shelby. A woman like tracked him for miles because she recognized his car. She recognized the description of him. I mean, this woman was on his tail until authorities could get to him. I mean, that just really amazed me. And it made me feel good that, you know, people are actually looking out for other people, you know?
You're preaching to the choir on this one. You know, in 2009, my hometown became the site of a massacre.
Oh.
So, and it was very strange being 1,300 miles away and seeing CNN live coverage. It does make your stomach churn. I think you're right.
I mean, and this is not to make light of anything that happened in Charleston. I mean, that is really where all of my emotions were. And then to hear that, then my hometown mixed in with that, I'm like, oh God, you know what? This is insane, you know?
Was there a bit of homesickness in you as you see that?
I don't know. All I felt was dread. I mean, for a lot of that, all I felt was dread. That's pretty much what I felt. That's it. Because already earlier that day, I'm already feeling intense emotions for the people, you know, who have been murdered at a church in Charleston. And then hearing that later on in the day, it just made it more emotionally intense. I mean, that's a very mild way to describe, you know, I think all the emotions that people are going through that day, and even me, you know?
Yeah. And no, we're not making light of anything here. It's like, yeah, suddenly seeing, oh wait, now Shelby's going to be part of the history of this.
Yeah, exactly.
Now part of the story.
Yeah.
Let's change it a little bit here. What is awesome about Shelby? Because the way it sounds to me is a small town in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
How small are we talking here?
Well, it's about 20,000 people, maybe a little bit bigger now because it's grown. There's like a bypass that's been built to go through there to help people get to Charlotte a little bit quicker. So you can get to Charlotte pretty fast from Shelby. But also, one of the fathers of bluegrass is from there. Earl Scruggs is from there, and there's an Earl Scruggs Museum.
That's where I know the city from.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's a point of pride for me. And then also, you know, there's some of the best liver mush is made there. You know, there's a lot to be proud of.
I got to stop you right there, Julie, because I don't know what you mean by liver mush.
Okay, well, how to describe this? It's like a liver. It's called liver pudding, and I think it's made from liver, and there's a lot of other ingredients that go in it. I'm not a foodie, so it's really hard for me to describe any kind of food to tell you what goes in it. But it comes in a square, and you slice it up and you fry it. And it's really good. People will eat it cold on sandwiches. I always ate it hot. We always had it hot at home. But it's one of those traditional sorts of things.
Oh, I'm probably going to get like emails saying, oh yeah, well, I got a can of it here. I'll send it to you.
Well, it comes in a package too, and you have to keep it cold. It's delivered. So it's made like the best that I've ever had is Nieces. That's a company that's around that area. Next time I go back to Knoxville in the fall, I'm going to see if I can find some.
Have it imported.
Yeah, my husband would love, I mean, that's one of the things that we try to have every time we go home and see my parents. We have to try to have, you know, some of the local foods that you can't find much of anywhere else in the South, and you definitely can't find up in Michigan. So,
do you send away for stuff like that from companies in the South and be like, hey, send me a case of whatever?
You know, not really. I think the only thing that I've actually brought home is country ham, because it's easy to travel. It's already packaged and cured, so it's a little bit easier to carry, and you don't have to refrigerate it. Like liver mush, you have to have refrigerated. That's all there is to it. Like a country ham, you can buy it at the grocery store, and it's sealed, so you can actually take it back. But no, we don't really do much of that. I think that we've been pretty good about acclimating even food-wise to certain areas. I mean, there's always stuff that we miss, and there's foods that my husband will make that are close to what we have back home. But no, we don't ever really do that. I mean, I've been surprised that we don't, but we just kind of try to embrace where we are, too. I mean, I don't want to feel like I'm not part of the state that I've been living in for the past 9 years, you know?
Yeah, so you've grown to be a part of Upper Michigan. I've grown accustomed to your face, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's beautiful up here, you know? And I like the people, and it's very small town feeling to me. People are really welcoming. It feels a lot like where I grew up, except that there's, you know, we have a coastline, God knows how long.
And there's snow.
Yeah, which can be complained about only in February and March. No earlier.
Why not earlier?
Because everybody's tired of it by then, too. And so you have a reason to complain. You find that when you acclimate, when you get used to a place, everybody hates the same things you do.
It's like the first couple snowfalls are wonderful. Like, oh, they're so pretty, I'd forgotten. Maybe on the holiday, they're beautiful. But after that, oh, go to hell.
I mean, January, I can bear. I can bear January. By the end of February, and, you know, also, by then, you've had it for 3 months, and it gets really, really cold by February. If you're really unlucky, it gets cold, really cold in November, like what happened last year. We got really, really cold, and like we had negative temperatures at that point. By February, the snow banks are really high, almost as high as stop signs sometimes, because the roads are plowed, and the snow banks get pushed up against the sides of the roads. They get taller and taller. And you're dealing with negative temperatures at that point, so that's when it really just starts to bother you and really get under your skin.
I used to call it tundra season in New York.
That's right. You know, it's not unbearable. I mean, you can get through it, but it can really bother you after a while. And you're stuck inside a lot of the time, too.
And so is everybody else.
Exactly. And so we all start driving each other crazy. It's flu season at that point. Everybody's getting sick. Everybody wants to go outside. It gets a little bit much.
It does. You only go out if you absolutely have to. And I know that.
And you better protect that face.
Oh, yes. I've grown older. I've realized that, oh, yeah, Neutrogena on the hands or hand lotion could be a wonderful thing in the middle of winter.
Especially, I mean, my skin gets so already prone to dry skin already, but then in the winter it gets even worse, and I'll have bleeding knuckles, and there has to be like I always think of bleeding gums Murphy when that happens, but I'm like, no, that's bleeding gums. I got to think of bleeding knuckles. So I'm thinking of some sort of nickname I can give myself when that starts to happen.
That's like a childhood game, bloody knuckles.
Exactly.
Just let nature do it for you instead of the school bully, you know?
And that's how bad it is up here. The weather is beating you up.
Stop freezing yourself. There we go.
Exactly. There you go.
As a Southerner, how many years did it take you to acclimate to the northern winter?
It took me about 2 or 3, because I was wearing the wrong clothes for a little bit. I mean, you don't wear snow pants too early. I learned that because a neighbor made fun of me for wearing snow pants too early.
Thermal underwear is a godsend.
You know, you'd be surprised that here you don't need it as much, because we don't have like straight line winds as bad in the city. By the way, but in the background, I have my windows open, and you're probably hearing a lawnmower right now. So just wanted to let you know that that's there.
We'll let it go. It's Upper Michigan. You only get a few weeks of summer every year.
But yeah, as long as you, I mean, I had a friend who lived in South Dakota, and they have a lot of straight line winds there. And it's much, much colder than it is here. So I thought, I'll wear thermal underwear. I would get so hot. I'd be fine outside, but then I would get inside and I would start to sweat. So I figured, you know what? I think I'm going to forego it, because it's pretty warm inside. And most of the areas around the buildings here the rooms aren't that big. And even in your own house, the rooms aren't huge. A lot of these houses are kind of old, and the rooms are relatively small upstairs because of the heat. You can't have large rooms. You have to heat them all winter long, and it costs a fortune. I learned that pretty fast, that I needed to dress for the weather outside, but as long as I wore layers, I was okay.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, thermal are very good in straight-line winds and gusts, but I learned after a few years, style means nothing in the middle of winter. Fashion sense doesn't mean anything.
Fashion sense doesn't really mean a whole lot up here. I mean, I've also gotten acclimated to, you know, not dressing up a whole lot. You know, when I lived in Lexington, Kentucky, I felt like I needed to kind of present myself more. But here, nobody cares. Nobody cares what you wear. They don't really care about that sort of thing. You're putting on airs if you try to do it too much. That's kind of where I'm from. I mean, like in the South, especially in a small town, if you try to overdo it, you're just kind of putting on airs, you know. So I've just gotten to where this place is really relaxed fashion-wise, you know. And because we have to gear up so much during the winter, it really doesn't matter.
Only people in my hometown that cared about fashion in the winter were people going to the clubs downtown, the college kids. And no, there's no fashion in the winter. But anyway, so, you know, you're not our first Michigan guest on this program. We've had Janine Rastel on with her husband before, and I know they're right in your backyard, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Right in the same area.
They're close enough. Yeah, they're pretty close.
And we had a long discussion when they were on the program about the outdoors of Michigan and such, and I'm wondering your perspective on it. Do you do a lot of outdoorsy stuff in
Michigan? I'm kind of a homebody. I've been that way my whole life. When we first moved up here, I think I was, because there was a lot to see that we hadn't seen before. I mean, I spend a lot of time outside in the summertime because it's summer, first of all. But, you know, I've got a backyard, and I've got a nice little place to kind of hang out. I'm not as outdoorsy as other people. I don't go on hikes. I try to go out to the lake a couple of times a summer. But I'm not as much as other people. I wish I were. But a lot of people do love it. I mean, there's a lot of snowbirds up here. There's a lot of people who come up here just to snowmobile during the winter and to ski, cross-country ski, and to go snowshoeing. So there are a lot of people who do love that sort of thing up here. But me, I'm afraid I'm a little lazy. But I wouldn't call it laziness. I like sitting down and reading a book, Scott.
There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody's got their thing.
I have a lot of outside seating in my yard, and a lot of plants. So I make it to where it becomes its own room in the summertime, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And also, I just don't have a whole lot of time. You know what I mean?
Oh, you're talking to the choir on that one.
I mean, that really takes a lot of time to get up and go, and, you know, and to get a teenager out of the house. That's another thing. When she was younger, we could get up and go. But now it's like, oh, no, I don't. It's a fight.
There was a time when they didn't understand what 6 o'clock meant. Then they get to be teens and they forget that 6 o'clock exists.
I think for the most part, she's pretty good about going along with us. But I mean, she does need her own time, and it takes her a little while to get going. So if you want to plan something, you better plan it ahead of time. You can't just get up and go. That's another thing, is that you have to have the time, and then you have to actually make the time and make the plans. So, but no, that's not to say I want to go out to the lake. There's a beautiful lighthouse about 30 minutes from me called Point Iroquois. It's right on the lake, and it's beautiful. It's one of my favorite spots. They have little nice walking piers, actually, like these little, well, I don't call them piers, but like raised walkways through the woods. It's just so gorgeous out there. You can take your dogs, and you can wade in the lake. It's just really nice, and it's not far.
It sounds like a nice little park-type place with a lighthouse attached to it.
And it's so quiet. Yeah, it's so quiet. They have some rooms set up that look like the rooms when people used to live there. They have a little gift shop. I think they actually have some kind of nautical things as well in there. So it's just a really cool place. And plus, the landscaping is really beautiful, too. So it's a really nice place to go out for that. But it's one of my favorite little places in Michigan, in the UP. And it's not far from home either, which is what I really like.
Thanks to the internet and doing a podcast, I'm looking at pictures now. And it's a very lovely, lovely lighthouse.
Yes. Yeah. And you can actually walk. You can actually climb the stairs to the top of the lighthouse and look out. And it's really beautiful in the fall when all the leaves are changing. It's a really nice little canopy of leaves when you get all the way up there. The first time we actually went there, it was fall. And it was really, really beautiful. But it's nice anytime. Maybe even winter. Maybe I'll chance that someday. The lake is actually really, really gorgeous during the winter. I mean, it's frozen. It's nice to see the snow on the lake. I haven't actually done that yet, but that's something I do want to do once I get the cojones to go out there and do it.
Well, I know from previous shows and such that Upper Michigan sounds like a paradise to me. It speaks to my inner upstate New Yorker.
And we even have a place called Paradise, Michigan.
I think my retirement place is now settled.
And there's cabins up there, and it's right near a huge waterfall called Taquamenon. Whitefish Point's out there. That's another place that has a lighthouse. It's gorgeous up there.
Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful little paradise to me.
No, it is. It really is. I mean, when I moved up here, a friend, someone who taught it at UK, and he still teaches there, he was a comp rep professor. He was like, "That's God's country." He was right. I mean, and God has a lot of country, you know. Kentucky is really, really gorgeous, too. I loved every moment that I spent there as well. But it is really beautiful up here. It's easy to fall in love with.
Been through Kentucky a number of times. I have family there in South Kentucky, mm-hmm. near the Tennessee border. So, yeah, it is beautiful country. I love the whole Appalachia chain, to be honest.
Yeah, if you just don't look at the mountains too long because they've just really stripped them down, they look rather ugly. But people are really fighting to protect those mountains too, because they love them so much. So the first time I saw a strip mined mountain, it just, because I was used to the mountains in North Carolina, it just floored me because I'd never seen anything like it before. And it made me really angry too, to know that someone would do that to the mountains that old and mountains that beautiful. So there are a lot of people still fighting to protect those mountains.
I can't name a state in this union where there's bad country to look at.
You're right. There's not. I mean, there's not an. I'm sure some people would argue with this, but there's really not ugly country unless there's been some kind of construction to kind of mar it in some way.
I was almost going to say Jersey is some of the least, but then I remembered, oh yeah, Jersey has the Pine Barrens.
Oh yeah.
What is the most interesting thing you've learned as a Southern transplant in Michigan about the Michigan way of life? Like, what was the most interesting thing you learned?
Oh geez.
I know that's a tough, vague
question.
That's
a tough part because I don't really think about it that much. I think I've lived up here for so long now that it might not be odd to me.
Well, let me rephrase it. Do you even feel like a transplant anymore, or do you feel like a native?
I don't know. I feel kind of half and half. I mean, I feel like I know how to talk to people pretty well up here. I mean, and because mostly I've kind of learned that people are the same everywhere you go anyway. I mean, if you're from a rural area and you move to a rural area, especially if you grew up in one, which I lived in cities for a while before I moved up here. And when I moved here, it kind of felt like home, so I automatically knew. That's a really hard question. I don't really feel like much of a transplant. I feel like I fit in here. I mean, I still feel a little weird, you know. I'm a writer. I'm a professor. I'm a little bit different because of what I do, you know, because for the most part, a lot of people here do work blue-collar jobs. You know, because we have some universities here, but we don't have as many universities as probably like Downstate does or North Carolina does. So for the most part, people either work at the hospital here or they work at the university, and not all professorial jobs. There are some engineers here, but there are also people who work construction. There are people who work in welding. So there are a lot of different kinds of people here. And I want to get to know different kinds of people. I don't want to just be stuck at only known professors at my job. But I do feel a little strange because I'm a Southerner. You know I'm a Southerner. I mean, I still have a Southern accent when I talk. So I don't feel much like I don't belong here. But I do feel like there's things that set me apart if I think about them too much.
But you try not to think of them that much.
No, I don't really talk about myself as a writer. Unless people ask me where I teach, I don't tell them.
I'm a teacher.
Yeah, I don't want to stand out. I don't want people to think differently of me just because I teach at the college. Because that's what they'll ask you. Teach at the college? Oh, yeah, I teach at the college. But that doesn't mean that I'm a highbrow person you can't talk to.
Do people really think of you or I differently when they find out we're writers?
Well, when they find out that you're an English teacher, they think they have to talk differently.
Yeah, I've gotten that.
But I've gotten to where I will not always use proper grammar in my classroom. So that my students know that you can still be a regular person and use slang, but your writing had better be pretty perfect if you're going to get good grades and if you're going to communicate well. But you can still be a real person and be a writer. You can have interests just like everybody else. You can talk just like everybody else. You don't have to be this person who's strange and speaks this other language. So yeah, I don't want there to be a barrier between what I do and who I am. I think of myself as a writer who teaches, but at the same time, I think of myself as a person who writes. I mean, I'm a person first.
Yeah, I feel that way when I'm driving. Actually, I was on a road trip recently, and I think at a pilot station or, you know, one of those family-type truck stops. And I'm sitting there in a ratty, beat-up T-shirt that I've had for years and a pair of beat-up jeans. And I was like, nobody around me knows I have a PhD in English. One look at me, you wouldn't even think it.
I think that's a good thing. I think that we, as academics, should not always set themselves apart. I just want people to see me as a regular person, not as someone who does this other work that might seem like I'm better than. I don't want people to think that I think that I'm better than everybody else, because I don't want to feel that way, and I don't think that way. I don't think that my neighbor who's a welder, I don't think I'm better than him, and I don't want people to think that I think that. It has always really, really bothered me, because if anyone ever found out that, you know, like I said before, if anyone ever found out I was a teacher, oh, I'd watch my English. No, you don't. You don't have to watch your English around me. Don't start thinking that I'm going to judge you for a certain way because you know who I am or what I do for a living. And also, likewise, I also don't like it when people try to correct my grammar because I'm an English teacher and they think I should know better. Are you kidding me? No, don't do that.
I tell them that's actually the benefit of my degree, that I get to mutilize the language as I see fit to.
I get to know the difference. And I get to play with it, too. That's another thing. That's also the beauty of it, is I get to mess around with it so that I can do the play on words perfectly fine, you know? Yeah. But, you know, don't shame me because you think I should know better.
I don't shame people for grammar, but I will make snarky remarks behind the back about a bad sign or something.
Oh, gosh, yeah, because then, I mean, you are presenting something to the world that has grammar mistakes on it, but you're wanting to seem professional at the same time, then you better fix the grammar mistake. But that's different. I mean, if someone is making a sign, that's, you expect that to be professional. And so that's different than correcting someone's grammar when you're having a conversation with them. I mean, that's totally different.
You know, as an English teacher, professor, I got to ask, when people find out, you know, let's say they ask, you're a teacher, what do you teach? I teach English. It's been my experience here, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. It's been my experience that somebody will say, oh, English? They'll say one of two things. Either, I loved English, or, oh, I really hated English class.
Or, I'm a really bad writer, or something like that. Yeah, that's usually, they will always say one of those two things. Or if they're in the English class, they're a student of mine, I hate writing, someone always told me I was bad at it. Well, I'm going to change what you think. Or try.
Yeah, it's never like, well, I always struggled with writing, but I really enjoyed the classes I took, and it was fun. I never hear anything like that.
Right. I hear that every once in a while. It's not very often I hear it. It's not very often I hear anyone saying, I love English. It's always like that they hated it for some reason. And but I always know if they say that, they had a bad experience. Because the ones who had the good experience are few and far between. So it makes me wonder, oh my God, what did a teacher do to them?
When I first started teaching, one of the first experiences I had in an office hours was a student telling me, they told me the story, and this has always bothered me, a K-12 teacher actually leaned down to the kid in English class and said, why are you here? And I think that really informed my sensibilities as a teacher, that
yeah.
I would never, ever say that to a student, ever.
I mean, we should be, as teachers, trying to make as much as we can, no matter what kind of crap we have to put up with from outside the classroom, we should be trying to make that experience the best we can for every student who comes in that classroom. And I'm not talking about just English teachers. I think every teacher should be trying to do that. Because my daughter will one day have a math teacher she loves. She hates math because it's frustrating to her. But the teachers help her in her school, help her try to understand exactly what's going on so she can think about it in her way and not necessarily someone else's way. But I think it's the job of every teacher to make the classroom a positive learning experience and a positive place and never make a student feel like they shouldn't be there. I mean, that's not our job to weed people out. Students will do that on their own, not by anything that we do.
So what do you do as a teacher to make a positive class environment?
I get to know my students. I talk to my students. I learn their names. I talk to them on campus. If I see them Sometimes I have to ask their names a couple of times. If I see them outside the classroom, I will always forget their names. In a different environment, my brain's gone. Once I get to know their names, I'll kind of make small talk with them if I see them on campus, ask them how they're doing. If I know that they're frustrated, I'll try to ask them what's frustrating them. Sometimes they won't let me. I just try to make it so they feel like they're welcome in my classroom. And I try to make it as much of a community as possible. Something that I started doing a couple years ago, instead of doing peer review, I have small group workshops so they get to know other students in the classroom, and they get help on their work pretty frequently from other students and from me. So I'm trying to build a community in the classroom more and more so they don't feel like when they come in, my work sucks, I don't deserve to be here. No, what happens is that your work might stink right now, but you're going to be able to revise it and make it into something better or a better product, whatever you want to call it. And I even start the first day, I tell them, if you're in my classroom, you're a writer. No matter whether you consider yourself one or not, you are. So for the next, 4 months, you're going to be a writer. I think it's just about creating community. If you can create community within a classroom, you can make the students feel, you can make them feel comfortable with each other, feel comfortable with the assignment. I mean, some of them will be better writers than others based on the experience. But for the most part, I don't want any of them to feel like they can't do it. Some of them you can't save, you can't make everybody think that they're the best, that they're good at what they do. But for the most part, you can make students believe in themselves and believe that what they have to say is important. I mean, that's really one of the main things.
I can't save everyone in the classroom, but I'm going to damn well try.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm going to try as much as I can, but at the college level, they are really responsible for themselves, and you can't babysit them. So at some point, you have to just let go. You've done your best, you've tried, but you have to let go at some point, because if they don't fail at something, then they can't learn how to try to succeed at some point. You know, everyone's fail better, however that saying goes. I can't remember exactly the quote, but
find me a writer who's just always been perfect and wonderful and never had a failure.
Oh no, I know. And because I am a writer, I also share the kinds of things that I've felt or that I've experienced or things that work for me. And we also talk about that. We talk about what times of the day work best for us. So I not only try to make them feel comfortable in the classroom just as a community, but also let them know that this is hard for everybody. It's hard for me, and I've been doing this for years, and I tell them how many books I've published, and I tell them every time I sit down, it's still hard, but I have to do it.
I tell my students that I got called out, and this is true, on my dissertation for misusing a semicolon.
Mm. What do they usually say to that?
They look at me kind of blank stare, and so I tell them, look, I'm no better a writer than anyone in this room. The only reason that I'm at the front is that I've spent years of my life dedicating myself to studying this.
And practicing.
And practicing and doing it a lot. But I will never show them my first drafts.
No, I wouldn't either. Because they'll think your first drafts are better than theirs, and then you can't do that to them.
Even then, my first drafts are totally terrible, and I know it.
Well, another thing is that I think that telling them that if they want to be better at something, they have to practice is really important for them. And also, sharing any Anne Lamott essay is perfect for them because she just nails everything. Shitty first drafts I always share with my students. Always. I either read it to them or I give them a copy. And at that point, they're like, oh, so everybody else really does feel the same way. Yeah, I've been telling you that all semester. But if you share Anne Lamott with them, then they're like, oh, yeah, okay. But I just always make sure they know that if they practice, you'll get better if you practice. And I compare it to other things that they do. Like I ask them if they play an instrument, if they build something, if they hunt. Well, you don't get better at anything unless you practice. And it's the same for writing. If you haven't written a paper in a while, you're probably going to feel really rusty. Well, you know, I haven't written a poem in 2 weeks, so I'm feeling really rusty too. And so I got to get back on the horse and I've got to practice again or I'm not going to get any better. So I think that also lets them know that this is just like any other profession or anything else you do. You got to practice to get better. If you don't work on your writing maybe a couple of times a week, then you're not going to see any kind of improvement.
I would totally agree with you on that.
But you have to tell students that. You know, we already know, right? Mm-hmm. You have to tell students that because they don't believe it until they actually sit down and do it and they see themselves improving like assignment after assignment. So they have, and I also tell them, you got to put your butt in the chair or you're not going to get any work done. So just sit down and do it. And I even tell them 10 minutes can get you a lot of work done. So those kinds of things that we learn that we learn as writers, any kind of things that we learn that work for us, we have to tell our students so that they can start to figure out what works for them.
When I talk about outlining and such, I'll show, this is how I do outlines. It's not how a lot of people do it. But I said, you got to plug away and try until you find the method that works for you. This one works for me.
And some of them come in and they already know. They already know what works for them, and that's cool. But I also tell them, keep an open mind, because you might be adding something to that, to that little menagerie that you already have of things that work for you.
What do you see as the biggest issue when your students come into your comp classes, let's say? The biggest obstacle you face?
They don't want to read. Seriously, they don't want to read. Or they try to read. One of the things that I'm working on, and I started working on it last semester and really noticed it, is that they try to make meaning out of everything. And I'm talking freshmen to seniors. They want to put meaning on everything. They think it's going to be easier to understand it if they can plug some meaning into it. But once I tell them that you just have to, you have to read and reread, it takes them a little while, but they don't want to read. They really hate reading if they feel like they're slow readers. They don't realize that you have to read something more than once to really understand it. They know that by the end of the semester, but when they first start, the reading really bothers them. And sometimes the language of the assignments bother them because they haven't ever had that assignments on that level with that kind of vocabulary. But really it's the reading. I could have them write all day, no problem. I could ask them to write something, they'd be like, okay, I'll write it, but sit down and have to read something, even if it's 3 pages long, Scott, is like pulling teeth for them. So not everybody, but for the most part, and that's the one problem that I have, is sometimes they just won't do the reading because they didn't want to sit down and do it. And I always think of these things like after the semester's over and before the semester starts. You know, we're in the middle of the summer and semester's going to start in like a month and a half. And I'm thinking, okay, what kind of things am I going to do differently, you know, next time? But yeah, that's one of the biggest problems I see right now.
Yeah, I found that too a lot. I started thinking of it as, are students reading more or less today? And I decided they're reading more. When you factor in all of the different websites out there and social media, they're reading more. It's the reading that's changed. And so I said, okay, I'm going to dump about half the essays from the textbook and go, here, read a BuzzFeed article. They have long forms.
Right.
Read this article from whatever business site and then help me identify who is this targeting. Yeah, but you're right. They are afraid of reading. There's something about reading that scares them.
And it's usually because they think if they're in an English class, they won't have the right answer. And so it takes me a while to help them figure out that in my class, there is no right answer. The only wrong answer is if you don't do the work and you don't answer the questions. That's the wrong answer. But you can't be wrong in my class. If I don't understand something that you're talking about, I'll ask you about it and I'll get you to develop your answers or develop your conversation about whatever you've chosen to talk about with the essay. But I think there's a big fear that they just won't get it right. But to have that feel of failure so easy, so early, it's baffling to me because I'm on the other side of it. Because I would have no problem talking out in class now. But as a freshman, yeah, I would have. So just kind of getting them to kind of face that fear and kind of get past it. Because there are still some students who are just painfully shy, who are really, really bright and write these wonderful responses, but then won't speak up in class because they don't want to be embarrassed in front of their peers. And then some of them are just afraid to be wrong. So that's another thing that I want to work on as a teacher, is actually making them feel more comfortable so they don't feel embarrassed or they don't feel like they're idiots, because they're not idiots. None of my students who walk into my class are idiots. They're not. But they have this feeling that they're in the English class, they can't get it right, they must be wrong.
I put a lot of blame personally on the K-12 system as it is. Not teachers, the system.
Mm-hmm.
You restrict the students a lot. You force them to think, okay, all of Shakespeare has to have deep meaning.
Even this article about vampires in pop culture has to have this deep meaning. No, it does not. Read what's on the page. Well, and I have to ask them to go back to the page constantly. Go back to the text. What does this text say? Because they think I'm looking for this overwhelming, deep answer. Uh-uh. What's on the page? What does the text say? That's all I want you to tell me. And I have to do that over and over for them to believe that's where the answer is. It's in the text. I mean, when we write book reviews, we deal with the text. We don't look for some overall meaning. The text gives us that. And so if we work with what's on the page, then we get exactly what we're supposed to get. It's not difficult. And they don't realize that it's not that difficult. It's pretty damn easy.
Is it a lack of trust? Do students distrust us? Like, they think we're tricking them or something?
I wonder if that's it. And if they think that we have this specific answer we're looking for, which is probably what happens to them a lot. There's a specific answer. They don't get it right. They fail. They fail that question. Yeah, maybe it's level of distrust. It's also the trick, which is also ties into that whole right answer sort of thing.
The first question I ask students about any reading, any one I give them, is a simple one. Did you like it or not? And anyone who reads it can answer. But students are afraid to answer that question because they think I'm tricking them somehow.
Now, I do not let my students tell me that. Because if they tell me whether they liked it or not, that doesn't give me an idea that they understood what they read. So when they tell me that they didn't like it, I usually ask them, I let them tell me that, but I don't let them pass judgment on it based on that. So we go back and look at the choices the writer made. Why is this working or why is this not working? So especially upperclassmen, I never let them use that kind of value judgment, because then I know that they're not really looking closely enough at what the writer's trying to do. So, yeah, I'm kind of bad about that. I don't let them tell me whether they liked it or not.
No, I think it depends what your purpose is in the classroom. If you're using that as the jump point for your conversation of, well, let's talk about why we like or dislike something.
Right.
And is that the fault of the author or is it the fault of the reader? That might work, but I guess I think it does come down to what is your aim with that lesson?
Yeah. But I think it's a good question to ask them. I mean, especially first question, did you like it or did you not like it? Well, let's find out what the writer's doing here that pushes us away or pulls us in. Because usually if they read E.B. White, pulls them right in. I mean, especially that Once More to the Lake. I got kids who are pretty much lake kids. They've gone to the lake every summer. They pretty much live for it. And Scott Momaday works for them, but you give them anything that's too political or something like that, right away they're not really sure what to think about it. Or if it's an analysis, it might push them away because it's looking too deeply. It just depends on what it is. But yeah, sometimes I can kind of figure what they're going to like and not. And we always talk about those sorts of things that push them away or pull them in, because that's a choice. I mean, then you have to think yourself as a writer, how you're going to do that. How are you going to pull the reader in? What kind of tactics are you going to use to do that?
We're writers. We read our friends' books. We read strangers' books. We read a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the first thing we do when we finish a book? Wow, I really like that. Or, whoa, I wasn't into that as I thought I would be.
Or halfway through, we're like, I'm not going to finish this.
I'm not. This is not my book. Sorry.
No.
I'm done with it. I mean, we value judge all the time as writers.
I know we do. And I try to get my students, because they're so young, and because they're not experienced readers, to really look at what exactly it is that's making them feel that way. So that when they're asked that question, if they like something or not, even if it's a movie, they should be able to say, well, I didn't like the way this was presented, or I didn't like this character and the way this character played out, or I didn't like the plot for this reason. And they can actually say it. They become critical thinkers, and they can actually give you a report on what worked and what didn't.
The biggest question you can ask is why. You come out of a movie theater with your friends and somebody says, I really hated that film, and you say, why? It's fun to do that when you're that friend when you're that friend.
Oh, God. And then you become that friend.
I knew there was something weird with me when I'm in high school going to the movies with my friends. I'd come out, and the only question I would ask them is, what did we learn today?
Oh, did you really?
It became a game, because we would try to come up with the most ridiculous thing we learned from the film.
Oh. But that's great, because then you start to look for things while you're watching the movie, because you kind of expect that question probably at the end.
It makes you pay attention more.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're looking for that, I gotta cap everyone when we get out of here on this one, so.
We've been watching the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Have you seen that yet on BBC America?
No, I have not.
Oh, it's good, it's good. You can catch it if you guys still have... You saw BBC America. It's great. It's very magic related. But there's an evil fairy in there, and I've never really seen an evil fairy before, so it's pretty cool. That's what I'm learning from that. Fairies are evil.
I don't know much about fairies.
I always think fairies are pretty good. You know, Grimm's fairy tales are pretty good, but no, this fairy's evil.
You watch a lot of BBC America?
I do. I watch, not a ton. I mean, I have a lot of favorite shows. Like, I love Graham Norton. I like Sherlock and Doctor Who, depending on who's playing the Doctor. I loved Call the Midwife, and it was on. And then there's a new miniseries called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. or Norrell that's really, really good. It's based on a novel. And it's a miniseries, so it's not an actual series. But yeah, there's certain things that I like. There's a lot of things that I like on there. I like a lot of British drama. I do like British comedy too, but I've really over the past couple of years started falling in love with British drama and mystery a lot.
What's the appeal of British drama? I'm not saying that as like someone who doesn't understand, but what do you think the appeal is to you?
It can be kind of fantastic. I don't watch Downton Abbey, but I like drama that gets a little bit towards the fantastic. So I love mystery. And there's always a little bit of most of the mysteries that I watch, there's always comic relief. So I really like that about it. And there's a little bit of comic relief, I think, even in this miniseries. So dramas that I watch will usually have some of that mixed in with it, almost always. Midsummer Murders does that really well. I really like that a lot. So I don't love all British drama, but there are some that I really, really do like. And really, I tend to like the science fiction and mystery a lot. That's kind of where I go. But Call the Midwife is actually set in the late 50s, early 60s in the East End of London. So I like it if it's kind of historical, too. So there's some history going on there with poverty. And I like women's issues, too. So there's a lot about childbirth and midwifery in there, midwifery as they call it there. So if it's historical, I'll like it too, especially if it's during an era that I'm really interested in, like 50s and 60s. I really like that era in both American and British culture. But that drama is just great. And there's, again, comic relief in there because there's some characters that I really like. There's one in particular. Her name's Chummy.
There we are.
What the heck?
I have no idea what's going on there.
Congratulations on your thunderstorm, though. I would love to have one up here.
No, you don't.
Well, not to your degree, but still, I'd like to have one.
It's the good old Florida thunderstorm, 3 p.m.
Another thing I miss about the South.
The 3 a.m., it's like a freight train, I call it. So the 3 a.m. thunderstorm right on time. Knocks everything offline, and you know. So I apologize for that.
Hey, no biggie.
Anyway, so we were talking about British drama there before we were rudely interrupted by the nature. I don't even remember at this moment what we were talking about with regards to it.
I think just to make a long story short, because I was going in to Call the Midwife, I think, when we got cut off, that if drama does not have a bit of comic relief in it for me, I'm not interested. That's pretty much the long and short of it. I have to have it. I mean, I like to laugh. I don't like to always be sad and serious. So no. Yeah, a little bit of that is necessary for me.
Oh, even in Shakespearean drama, you have the clowns.
Yeah, exactly.
Which do you prefer to sit down with, comedy or drama?
It really depends on my mood. For the most part, comedy, though. I'm in my yearly binge of Frasier right now. Every year I watch the season all the way through, and it's always during the summertime. Always when I have time to sit down and watch it. So yeah, I really like comedy a lot. I do like drama, but for the most part, when I sit down, I like comedy. I really do like to laugh because so much of what I do is pretty damn serious. So I don't need my TV to always be serious.
I agree. I'm starting now to work my way through Game of Thrones.
But Tyrion is the comic relief there, don't you think?
I think he is most of the comic relief. I would say most of it.
Well, who also do you think is comic relief on there?
Not straight out comic relief, but other characters do have their little moments.
Okay.
Khaleesi has her little moments every now and then.
Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, there are moments throughout it, but yeah, Tyrion really is the high point, I think, so far. But no, I totally understand. I grew up, actually, you and I are very similar in our comic tastes, because I've often said two of my biggest comic influences are The Simpsons and Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Right. And mine were kind of always, I love slapstick a lot, probably more than I should. I really love somebody to get hit upside the head in a comedy, to fall down. I love physical comedy a whole lot. So that's one of the reasons why I love so much of the comedy that I do. I mean, The Simpsons, when Milhouse, one of the episodes, when he gets hit upside the head with the microphone and his glasses get knocked off, I think that's hilarious.
So are you a fan of, like, the Three Stooges?
Not Three Stooges, though. I mean, I really love I Love Lucy. That's one of the first comedies that I watched when I was growing up that I loved a lot. I love The Honeymooners. I like Buster Keaton a lot. Some Charlie Chaplin. I like Harold Lloyd, I think, is fantastic. I love Marx Brothers, especially Harpo Marx and Chico Marx. I like them a lot. So yeah, I like a lot of physical comedy. If a comedy like Frasier can blend the physical with the intellectual, you've got me. I think 30 Rock is really good at that too. 30 Rock is just really, really good writing, but at the same time, Tina Fey can do some really great physical comedy that just knocks me over. I love that sort of thing.
That's a show I've really got to go back over and see. I only saw a couple of episodes, some of the early ones with Tracy Morgan, and I thought this has potential.
You have to be in the mood for that show, though, because I can't just watch it on the fly. Like, I can watch Frasier anytime. I can sit down and put on Netflix and put on Frasier anytime, and I'll watch it. No problem. 30 Rock, I have to be in the mood for. So there are a couple of shows that's the case for me, but I think Modern Family is really, really good at mixing the two as well. And that also is written by the same people who wrote Frasier. So that's another reason why I like it. And I didn't know that until probably a couple months ago. Sofia Vergara is hilarious in that show. I mean, she has such good comic timing. I hope she's aware of that. You know, because sometimes some comedians don't really know how good they are at things, but she is really good at comic timing. Everybody in there is so good at comic timing. It's hilarious. And that's a show that I'm kind of coming late to. It's really funny. They do a really good job with that show. And I've recently gotten into Archer, even though it's really gross. It's really funny.
I was having a discussion with a friend of mine about that. He said, I should love it, but I don't. And I said, how familiar are you with the James Bond series? And he said, I'm really not. I said, there might be the issue. A very, very smart show, especially if you're aware of the genres it's playing in.
And that's why such good comedy works, is because if you understand the genre, then you get what they're trying to do.
Marx Brothers is a great example. On one level, it is just goofy, silly things, but then you go deeper and you're like, this is really smart in places. I recently just saw A Night in Casablanca for the first time, and I'm like,
Oh yeah.
how did this escape me, that climactic scene with the luggage?
Oh yeah. Oh gosh. I haven't seen that one in forever. Duck Soup is the one I watch over and over and over. But yeah, I haven't seen that one. I was trying to remember where that scene was. Thank you for reminding me, because it's one of my favorite scenes.
It is so brilliant for its timing and skill.
Mm-hmm.
I encourage all of our listeners, go out, find that movie, find the YouTube clip at least of the luggage scene.
Or watch, I would also add to that, watch Duck Soup. It's on Netflix. Just watch it.
Just
If you haven't
watch
watched Marx Brothers, go watch Duck Soup, because there's a hilarious scene in there with Chico and Harpo Marx and a lemonade, I think a peanut stand man or something, or lemonade stand
Yep,
man.
lemonade stand, and they're selling peanuts.
Yeah, peanuts. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm sorry going into it.
I will do it too.
It's hilarious. I mean, I can't. It's one of the first things that my daughter watched that she. I mean, she laughed out loud at Sesame Street, but that was one of the first movies she watched that she watched over and over and over. But by the time she was old enough to get it, like around 8, she got it. She got Groucho Marx's jokes. She got Chico and Harpo Marx's jokes. So I was just like, yes, my daughter gets it. Yes.
I have done my duty.
That's a
Yes.
proud moment for a mom. Or when she asks to watch I Love Lucy. Oh, yes, you may watch I Love Lucy anytime you want.
I feel that's the way I'd be about my children too.
I mean, she's at the age 12 now where she's kind of on the in between. You can't let her watch Amy Schumer, but she's tired of all the other things that she's watched for so long. So she's kind of in that in between age where I wish I could find something that was just perfect for her, because you can't let her watch the lewd stuff yet.
Let her find her way, and then, but know that she will always, I guarantee you, say when she's in her late 20s, early 30s, she will look back and go, the Marx Brothers are still better than half the crap right now.
Oh yeah, but
She'll
there
still
is some
like that.
really good stuff out there right now. That's the thing. You know, Netflix is doing some really good stuff. I think there's a lot of good stuff on, was it Comedy Central right now?
I almost gave up on television comedy, and then Key and Peele came along, and then Amy Schumer came on.
And then you got Archer too.
There is some good stuff out there right now. Maybe the young generation's got it. I don't know. We'll see what happens
You
here.
also have to think most of the people who are writing these shows are around our age right now. Because a lot of the music they're using or the jokes they're using, they're like, oh my gosh.
It's
You're
Gen
like
X
going back.
humor.
Yeah, you are. So you're like, I get all this. This is perfect for me. And I always get worried that in like 30 years, I'm going to get none of it. I hope I can stay up with pop culture enough that I don't ever kind of lose my connection to what's going on in our culture, and I can still get the comedy. That's what I love about comedy, is it can be recent for its time. you know, pretty much. It can be timeless, but at the same time, if it's good, it's also going to be very now. What's the word I'm looking for, Scott?
Very trendy, very contemporary.
Yeah, contemporary. It's very contemporary.
Ultimately, it's always going to come back. There will always be, you know, every kid will always find farts funny.
There were some fart jokes in an Archer episode the other night that I was like, I was just really laughing out loud at. I couldn't believe that I was laughing that loud at bodily humor, but I was, because it was just so perfectly done.
I hope when I'm an old man, I'm still finding fart jokes funny at times.
I mean, I think you get to the point, like, there's some part in your life where you kind of think, oh, that's not cool. Maybe I don't like that. And then you're like, no, that's really funny. I do think that is funny.
If I can pull an old chestnut I stole from Mystery Science Theater a long time ago, if I like the girl, who cares what I like? I forget what episode Joel says that in, but...
If this is the wrong room, I don't want to be right.
Exactly, you know? Julie, it is always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Before we let you go, before we send you back into the world of Michigan, and we try and dry out from the thunderstorm down here, where can the folks find you online?
I am at juliebrooksbarber.com, and my last name is spelled B-A-R-B-O-U-R.
And that's the best place to keep up with your wonderful writing?
With my publications, I post any poems that are published online. I publish them on a page that says poems. And then any books that are coming out, I'll keep like my books and chat books lists updated. And I have a new chat book coming out in the fall. Yay!
Excellent.
It's with Hermeneutic Chaos Press. They're pretty brand new. They're making hand-stitched editions of chapbooks. I think they're pretty much considering themselves a micro press because they're not going up past a certain page length. But I cannot wait to see the kinds of books they produce. I really already love their journal and the kind of work they do, so I'm really excited about that. And the chapbook's going to be called Beautifully Whole. It should be out by, I think, fall, at least.
Excellent. Well, let us know. We'll throw a link on our website there about it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. That was one that I wrote at my SAFTA residency. So if you haven't been to Firefly Farms yet, get on it. It's a perfect place to write.
I will attest to that as someone who almost never writes anymore, but found the impetus to go back to it when he was there.
Yeah, get yourself down there again, Scott.
Oh, I will. I'll be back in due time. It's a second home for me in a way now. You're also, speaking of journals, associated with Connotation Press.
I am Border Crossing. So I have two journals that I'm associated with.
Excellent. And, of course, you're on Facebook and not on Twitter, I believe.
Not on Twitter.
But for most info then, just go to juliebrooksbarber.com.
Yep, that's me.
Excellent. Well, Julie, it has been a pleasure having you on the program, as I said.
And thanks for the great conversation, Scott.
Well, thank you for giving the great conversation. And again, sorry about the nature thing, you know. I will talk to you soon, though, I'm sure.
Okay, thanks, right. Scott.
Take care.
Bye.
The SAFTA Cast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit saftacast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.